Welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. Thanks for joining me. I'm Scott Linden, your host. We're here in the Cabela's podcast studio. Lots to talk about this week on the podcast. Public access advice, traveling advice, a whole bunch of puppy advice from a pro breeder who will provide a perspective we didn't get last time around. And of course, the continuing saga of Flick, the German wire-haired pointer, all coming up this week on the Upland Nation podcast. How's your week going? Everything all right? You may be in one of those states where the lockdown is more locked than it was a couple weeks ago. Maybe it's not, depending on where you are, but you know, it's just weird, just very strange out there right now. And I guess if you worry too much about it, your head will explode. Get yourself a good distinctive face mask, because we're all having to do a little bit more of that these days. And then remember to social distance. Good place to do that is out training. My new mantra these days is train hard, hunt easy. Seeing it every day, we are making progress. Maybe you are too. What's your goal for the summertime? Is it steadiness? Is it a retrieve that is non-slip? Well, whatever it is, good luck on that. Maybe it's shooting. You been to the range lately? I was flattered a few weeks ago. I was invited to be the celebrity at the Redmond Rod and Gun Club coming up at their celebrity shooting event on August 16th. If you're in Central Oregon, hope to see you there. Come on out, see what they've done. Those volunteers, all volunteers, have done a great job. So keep up the good work, everybody, at the Redmond Rod and Gun Club. I'll see you out there on August 16th. Okay, just about ready for our guest. But before we jump into that, let's remind everybody that we are sponsored in part by Sage and Breaker Mercantile. Gun care products crafted at the highest caliber. Always free shipping. Get the catalog. Sign up for the mailing list. That way you'll find out about all the new stuff before everybody else. And check out some of the things I write for the blog over there, sageandbreaker.com. And Dogtra.com also makes this podcast possible. I love their T&B dual collar system. It is what is getting Flick steady and retrieving very well these days. I'll bore you with more of the details on that. I hope it's not boring later in the podcast, but you can learn more about all of their opportunities for discounts, freebies, bundle pricing, all of that at Dogtra.com. So joining me from somewhere in the upper right-hand corner of Oregon, a guy whose dogs I respect, and so thus I respect him as well. I have fondled a number of his puppies over the years. Kelly Jobes with Bone Point Kennels, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
You know, we first met briefly at a NAVDA test about four dogs ago for me, and I was struck by your dogs at that point because they were doing excellent work, and they were black and white generally, and for a German wire-haired pointer, that's slightly unusual, at least in America. Tell me, is that kind of one of your signature colors out there?
Well, it's kind of become that way, I guess, not entirely on purpose, but it was back in 2000 that we had a litter sired by a dog they brought in from the Czech Republic, and Ken Vosbet, and a pretty well-known dog amongst wire hair circles in NAVDA. And we used that dog and had a really nice female out of him that happened to be black, and kind of got a breeding program rolling. And at that time, there really weren't a lot of black dogs. Black wire hairs in the U.S. And I think since then there has become quite a bit more. I tend to see them more frequently, but yeah, at the time there weren't a lot. And at seeing a black wire hair with some good talent, generally kind of, oh, is that a Bone Point dog? And that's that. It did kind of make that connection there. So So yeah, that is has somewhat kind of become our trademark, and we haven't had a necessarily a preference towards the black, but we just keep what has the best talent, best all around dog, and there's been a lot of those black dogs that have continued down that path since that original one. So we tend to always have a few black ones.
And that's the kind of what I was just going to ask you. There, not every dog that comes out of your kennel is black and white or black and ticked or whatever. You're throwing brown dogs as well.
Yeah, most are brown. Because we don't breed black to black. It's just
Yeah.
frowned upon from getting too many in the breed, and so every black dog we have paired up with a liver, and so that statistically you'll get a 50-50 mix, and then we just have some liver dogs that are bred to liver, and of course you don't get black out of that. So, and I prefer to keep the liver just because it gives you more breeding options, but somehow a black one always surfaces at the top as the top performer and kind of makes its way in there. So it is what it
Go figure. There you go.
Yeah.
Well, you got a complicated life, and on top of everything else out there, when we last talked, you were heading down the road to assist your dad with 14 puppies and dew claw and tail work. Tell me how that all went.
Yeah, that particular female, Harley, is my parents' dog and my dad's personal hunting dog. And she generally has smaller litters, and my parents, they generally welcome them. I get them up here about 5 weeks. Well, she had 14 puppies, and that's certainly our record. All of them lived, all of them made it. They're a week and a half old now, almost 2 weeks. All are doing great. And so, yeah, that next day I was talking to you. I was on the road heading them back to Pendleton to help do tails and dew claws. And yeah, all went well. We've, of course, took them to that the first several litters and then thought, hey, we could do this. And pretty experienced at it now. So I do quite a few tails and dew claws every year.
I'm not one for that kind of stuff, from a personal sensitivity to blood, but it does work for a lot of folks. And in a nutshell, keep it less graphic if you can, but just tell us how you do that stuff, just for everybody who's never ever experienced that.
There are a number of ways to do it, but the way we do it and we like the best is involves a hemostat on the tail. We generally leave a little over 60%, and then you clamp a second set of hemostats on there, and then you twist it versus a cut, and that helps keep it closed, and it bleeds a lot less. Some will clamp hemostats and then cut and then put in a suture. By putting a second set and twisting off, then we get by with just a little dab of a super glue on top and there's very little blood. So actually, I now use a surgical glue, which is basically super glue. Super glue is not technically sterile, so
Yeah.
we used it for several years. But use more of a surgical glue, and it's just clamp, clamp, twist, dab of glue. And then on the dew claws, and that's just a quick hemostat clamp and a scrape with the fingernail, and you're off. And just keep that alcohol and keep the tail real clean up the tail and alcohol real quick before. Same with the dew claws, and it works out pretty well.
Oh, thanks. I don't think I'm feeling faint yet, and I'm not seeing black around the edges, so I appreciate that. Let's get a little bit of background on your operation. Tell me a little bit about Bone Point Kennels and what your philosophy is.
Yeah, I got started really young in the dog game. My uncle was the first that really got into hardcore chuck and iron, and he got short hair as my uncle Brian, and my dad followed suit real quick, and he got his first wire hair back in '93 from Jeff Hunty, where your source as well, and that kind of got the ball rolling. I was pretty young then when my dad got the second wire hair in '96. I was 14 at that time and really getting into hunting, and that's when I really took an interest in it, and this from there it kind of became a passion of mine. I started we bred her in '98, had a litter. I tested one of those puppies in natural ability. was, I think, 15, and I ran them the next year in utility and trained them myself. I mean, I got the guidance from my uncle, who was doing a lot of NAVs at the time, too. And my dad did a little bit, but he was mostly interested in hunting dogs. And he'd done a little bit of NAVs, too. But that really got the ball rolling, and I really took an interest in the breeding and just the challenge of putting together the perfect dog and understanding genetics. And so I just kept it through. So I went from high school and I was testing dogs into college and going to engineering school and running dogs in the meantime. And it's been kind of really a lifelong passion of mine. And yeah, raised a lot of dogs, ran a lot of dogs, but mostly had them just. And then back then we were living in Pendleton, and we were driving over to Snake River almost every weekend and truck running for 6 hours before we head back. So I just cut my teeth on that pretty young, probably too young in a sense, because it was a love-hate relationship when you're 13, 14, 15 years old and you're out there that long climbing hills. But that's when you start to get a respect and appreciation just for the burden, for the game, and realize the benefit of good dog work. And you start going through dogs and you find good ones and ones that do this right, ones that do this wrong, and some of it's training, some of it's the dog, and you're just through the years constantly working to training better dogs, breeding better dogs, and that's kind of where I am today. Just been doing that for a good 20 years now.
Yeah, and you said something that I'm intrigued by, and I think you'd be the first to agree that the perfect dog is probably unattainable, but excellence is attainable. I think Vince Lombardi said that first. But Vince Lombardi, he's a coach way back, first Super Bowl for all you guys under 30 years old. Anyway, you mentioned trying to breed the perfect dog. I mean, what does that mean? I mean, how do you do that? And what are you looking for?
Well, it's a little bit two-sided. I mean, there's the part that I mean, a hunter in me is looking to breed the best hunting dog, produce the best hunting dogs, and the breeder part of me knows it's one step beyond that. Not just breeding, producing the best hunting dogs, but also producing dogs that can then themselves reproduce themselves with great consistency. So there's a little bit of a difference there, but looking at it from the hunting standpoint, and then do that consistently, and all that's it's difficult. A lot of times you breed two dogs that you think have it all, and sometimes the results just underwhelm, and that happens. But that perfect dog, gal, that's different in the eyes of every breeder and hunter, and that's why we all. I mean, we can kind of. My perfect dog may not be somebody else's perfect dog, and that's fine. But over the years, I've kind of gravitated towards what I personally like, and that's what we've really strived to produce in our dogs. And for the most part, that's a pretty high-powered dog, compared to probably your average dog out there, or at least your average wire hair versatile. We've kind of been known to and made our mark just on producing dogs with really aggressive field searches and just good natural bird dog attributes. So you can just cut them loose and they're just going to go find birds. And you chase them around the hill from covey to covey and go from there.
So, describe in practical terms what a pretty good dog is to you. Range, style, the things that are important to you.
Well, I certainly like a good motor on a dog. I like them hot. I want dogs that, I mean, their eyes, they love birds and they want birds bad, and they'll go through the great lengths to find them. And just that high level of prey drive, and dogs with good amount of independence, where they'll go however far they need to find them. I mean, I have a couple right now. I don't actually hunt with a Garmin. Most of the time, I throw a GPS. I still run a beeper, but I need to go to a GPS. But when I have thrown them on there, I've had a couple of dogs that, I mean, they'll get out there 1,000, 1,500 yards at times on some big open chukar country, and that's in the tops, and that's the extreme, and those are years where birds are few and far between. I mean, most of the time, a 2 to 500 yard dog is about what I like. If I'm in the real steep stuff or the birds are real wild, I want to hold him in tighter. And then we're talking chukar, but I also expect the dog to, I'm going to hunt bluegrass with them, rough grouse with them. That takes a little different skill set that's unique to them. I also want them to sit in a duck blind and have the toughness and the grit to jump in the Columbia when there's ice chunks floating down the river and get the job done. And there's pheasants. I mean, that's a whole different skill set. And so, I mean, I want them hot, but they need to be able to switch gears too. If the dog just has overdrive and it can't switch gears, I mean that's the hallmark of a wire. And that means coming in the house and just being a good companion, having that good off switch, but also switching gears in between the different game you hunt and they all require a little bit different skill set. So
Well, that sounds like a versatile dog to me, and that's the whole point, isn't it?
no, that's exactly right. Maybe malleable. You switch gears. It's that's what a versatile dog is. And we might use them here a little differently than they do in Europe, but I mean the main point is can they switch gears and hunt what you ask them to and hunt and be successful whatever that species required. I mean, and there's things that need to be in all dogs. I mean, it's not just a personal preference. I mean, nose. I mean, that's nobody's going to argue that that's not important. Some birds require it more than others. And then there's caution, just natural pointing instincts, trainability, toughness, conformation, structure. There's a lot that goes into it. And then with our breed, we have coat. So, yeah.
Well, tell me a little bit
It's,
about let's do this two ways. I'm going to ask for variations on this answer, Kelly. By the way, you're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. Is that what I said? Yeah. And that's Kelly Jobes. He's the proprietor, trainer, breeder at Bone Point Kennels. Learn more about them at bonepointkennels.com and their wire hairs. And we'll get into the difference there in a minute too, Kelly. But first off, if you are a breeder, pro breeder, and you're looking to basically enhance your current string for breeding and performance purposes, you're going to look for certain things in a puppy or in a dog that maybe we won't look at as just a puppy buyer looking for our hunting companion. So let's take it one at a time. You're a breeder, you're looking to bring somebody, some other dog into your kennel for professional purposes. What are the attributes that you would look for there that maybe we wouldn't think of?
No, that's a good question. We've brought in. Oh, I just picked, got a puppy out of South Dakota this year. Amanda picked up. Picked one up last year as well. And I do try to pick up an outside puppy every other year, for that reason, just to see if there's new genetics that to add that can complement or improve what we have, and also just so I'm staying fresh and not getting kennel blind. I want to see the best of what's out there. So things I'll look for, consistency and the dog's ability, not just the dog and the parents, but what if when you look at the dog's parents and the pedigree, that gives you a good idea of the dog's ceiling as an individual performer. But I'm trying to look at it one step deeper in terms of I'm also looking for a dog that could be a great producer. And from there, you start digging into the parent siblings. Okay, what were each one of those siblings like? Was the litter good or was it a one-hit wonder? And you start looking for that depth and that consistency, and that gives you a better indication of what's under the hood in the dog when you start to breed it. Is it going to reproduce itself well? So that's a big part of it. And I'm also looking for the dog of the individual type that I like. And that's, as I mentioned earlier, I like a very aggressive field search, and not a lot of wire hairs are like that. But maybe I compromise a little bit on that if the dog has or the line has something that I think might it can improve my dogs. Maybe I'm trying to improve the structure of my dogs because I've been pretty field oriented, as an example. I always pay a lot of attention to really strong water work. But I'm looking, I pay attention to like NAB utility duck search scores. I think that's really important when you look at all of that and you're testing dogs that naturally go out and perform duck searches. Just to have that level of drive, I think that tells you a lot about the dog's engine.
Yeah.
And so that's important to me. Looking for good, stable mental temperaments, just good mental wiring matters a lot. I'll look for all that. And then also I'm generally going to go to someone that I trust to give me good info. We have a Wirehead Alliance and other just people that you trust that you've met through the breed. And you have to have a good level of trust if you're going to pick up a dog, because I'm sure many people are trying to get details on somebody's dogs and all she gets kind of the rose-colored version. Well, you need to work with people you trust so that you can get the dirt too. Dogs have weaknesses, and we need to know those weaknesses so that we can work around them genetically.
You mentioned the alliance, and I'll get back to that because it's really it's kind of linked to this. But before we do, so now put on your puppy buyer hat for a moment, Kelly Jobes, and tell us what you think are the important criteria when somebody shows up. They've already arranged to have one of your dogs. How are you going to help them pick the right dog, or do you pick it for them? And if you do, what do you do to match the two?
Okay, so you're talking they're already getting a dog from us, and they're coming to So that decision's already been made. Okay,
yeah.
We match up puppies with clients, and we do that for a few reasons. Sometimes I'll have multiple litters in the year, and granted, those litters are going to have far more in common than they are different every now and then. One may be a little stronger in one area versus the other. And so sometimes I'll move people or encourage people to get a particular litter based on that. But when it comes from the individual puppies within the litter, I match that up because I'm watching the puppies kind of. I mean, from birth to when we match them up at 7 weeks, and they generally get picked up around 8 weeks. And if you just have somebody come take a look at the puppies, they're just getting snapshot. I mean, they might see the true puppy, or that one might have just woke up from a nap, or it's having an off day, or whatever. Or maybe it's not the right dog for them, but they brought their kid and fell in love with this one because it had this great spot, or whatever. And so when people come get the puppies, I think sometimes it allows emotion to get in into that process, and I think separating that, and just if they tell me up front what they're looking for in their dog, I watch those puppies for 7 weeks and I do my best to match one. And granted, most of that matching is done when they selected us as a breeder.
Yeah.
And then we had those discussions, and I asked them, hey, what are you looking for? And if we both agree that it's a good match, then we proceed. And that's probably 80% of it. And then when you start picking the individual puppy, if you've already picked the breeder that you trust, that hunts like you and you have confidence in, and then you also pick the nice breeding that you've settled on, when you get down to selecting an individual puppy, it doesn't matter as much. You can, with the wire hair, there's coat. Sometimes there's some boldness or size or some things like that, but at that point you're kind of splitting hairs. So, I mean, I've been fooled so many times too. I think one's going to turn out this way, and it doesn't. So,
okay, so settle the bet, Kelly. You've been through this a lot more often than I have, but. You know, most of us are pretty familiar with a wire hair coat and what we might consider to be a pretty good coat. How can you actually tell it's going to be that, or most of the time at least, how can you tell much about the coat when the dog is 6 or 7 weeks old? Are you looking at the fringe on the ears? Are you looking at the feet? What do you look for?
And that is one thing that you... you can tell pretty well as code at that age. Not 100%, but pretty darn well. And the things I like the shorter coated dog, kind of short to medium with a good full beard. I'm looking at under coverage, the density, the harshness of the coat. I like a good, I want to see some good wire texture at a puppy. I like a pup that doesn't necessarily have a huge full beard, but just a start of a beard in the corner of the mouth. Sometimes those ones that have full beards as puppies end up maybe a little on the hairy side, which some people are like that, and that's fine. I don't tend to go on the hairy side, preferably. And I look for undercoverage. I want to see how they're covered on the underside.
The butt, the belly and the chest, you mean by that, right? Yeah. Good. All right.
And then there are some things you can just tell by looking at enough wire hair puppies, whether the puppies at a high risk to maybe get long and fuzzy or soft coated or things like that. And that just, if you've seen enough of them, you can kind of pick some of those out sometimes.
I bet. Yeah.
But and then sometimes you're looking in the corner of the mouth to see if a pup's actually going to have any beard or not. And sometimes those are tight. But
Yeah.
we're now doing a lot more DNA testing for the coat on the dogs, and not necessarily good coat or bad coat, but they have testing now to test for the furnishing gene, and we're doing a lot more of that, not just in our breeding stock, but breeders are doing that on litters as a whole. So that's the wire hair that comes out looking like a short hair, and as a slick coat is a recessive gene, and so we can now test for that.
Wow.
And so if you and granted, most of our breed does carry the slick gene. That's why a slick or two in every litter is pretty common, or at least in most litters. And so both parents have to carry that gene to get it. And that just tells you that a pretty high percentage of the breed does carry that. And so when you find those individual dogs that don't carry that gene, they will never throw a slick coat no matter what they're bred to. So that helps. That's just one aspect of the coat, but it is one thing that we now have the ability to do that we didn't 10, 20 years ago.
Wow. Well, that does lead logically into this whole discussion about an organization that you're active in, and my friend Jeff Funky is active in, and this is this whole Wire Hair Alliance, and we talked to Jeff at length about it. But these are the kind of things that you folks talk about. Do you want to just bring us back up to speed on how the alliance is going these days and what its goal is?
Sure. I listened to the one you did with Jeff here a month or two ago. That was a good one. But yeah, the Wire Hair Alliance, it kind of started.
Oh, well, what,
Jeff,
hold on,
he
hold
did.
on. First off,
Go
yours will be better than Jeff's.
ahead. So he gave me a call and said, "Hey, what do you think about getting this going?" And he did it in some capacity, calling it back in the early 90s, and kind of dried up. And he said, "Hey, what do you think about taking another run at this?" And so we started calling our fellow wire hair breeders that we knew would be good potential candidates, people out there that are breeding good quality dogs, and we knew we wanted to be a part of it. And that's what we wanted to form the nucleus of that alliance is breeders that we trusted, diehard hunters that were putting out good dogs, and people that we're mostly working with anyway, but we just wanted to unify it a little bit and grow up from there. And so we have, I mean, it's not a real big group, but it's, I think we have 12 members right now. We generally run about 12, 15, and we want to keep that quality. It's like I said, it's a good group of breeders, and we're trying to bring in a couple, one or two new breeders a year, as well, that are going to breed under the same requirements. And we have the set minimum requirements, and the whole alliance thing too. It's, I mean, you're seeing a lot more with the versatile breeds. I mean, the Poodle Clan one, they've had theirs a long time. I've heard even like the Fawn one's getting going here pretty soon. And there's other variations as well, and they've been largely pretty successful. I mean, I think until before we got started, I mean, there were good quality breeders putting out nice dogs, but it was we're all operating in our own little bubble. And you had little side groups and people going, they had conversations or maybe individual alliance, if you want to call it that, but making it a bigger one, unifying it and bringing a trust amongst the group. So where you're airing out the dirt on the dogs and you're having these honest conversations that's needed to move the breed forward. And you're all collectively agreeing on what's important and why and where do we want to set our minimum requirements now. And we're never going to police anybody into breeding good dogs. That's not why we set the minimum requirements. Those are just setting the bottom bar. I mean, you still have to have great individual breeders if you want to be producing very individual dogs. And so that's, that was where we started with. And I think it's, I mean, if you go and look at the wire hairs that have the past couple of years qualified for the invitational, I mean, a very, very high percentage of them are from Lions breeders. And we had a pretty good annual Zoom meeting here just a couple weeks ago, and it was a 3-hour meeting, and shooting to have a hunt out in South Dakota and another meeting here this fall. But yeah, good group of guys, and I think we're heading in the right direction, doing some good things, putting out some nice dogs that we're all really proud of.
And among other things, and I don't mean to trivialize this at all, but, you know, I fly too damn much, and you open up any of the in-flight magazines, and there's always an ad somewhere for the 12 top steakhouses or something like that. In a nutshell, what you guys are doing is you're saving us a lot of the work, just like that ad does. You've put together, in effect, a clearinghouse of great wire hair breeders. You're not buying ads in the Alaska Airlines magazine, but you've got a great website and people can go there and start a search with some element of confidence. And that is what I like about this alliance idea. It is quality oriented, and it is a starting point, at least for people who are looking for a slightly, as you said, slightly higher bar than Googling German wire-haired pointer breeders, for example.
Yep, and all those breeders, I mean, I think at the core, they were hunters first, and they got into the dog games and testing and all that second, and we have them spread around the country, and so they can, you know, offer people around the country that maybe are looking to hunt similar game. You know, hopefully there's a breeder nearby that hunts in a similar way you do.
Well, there you have it. Hold that thought, and then hold this one. When we get back together after a quick break, I want to talk about what you love most about this whole game. So Kelly Jobe, bonepointkennels.com is where you get more information. I've got the handle it feature coming up right after this. And this is acknowledging the sponsors who make this all possible, including Dr. Tim's Performance Dog Food. I just got my delivery today, and while my back doesn't like it quite as much as the rest of me or Flick, getting 40-pound bags means I'm getting pretty darn good value. I've commented on this before, the fact that, you know, the price of a bag of dog food seldom changes. The size, though, continues to get smaller and smaller. Not at drtims.com. That's drtims.com. A variety of formulations, regular delivery, and if you order at the website for that regular delivery, 30% off your first order with the code UplandNation. 30% off. No social distancing, no masks required for that online purchase and deliveries at drtims.com. And then I talked about my soon-to-be celebrity appearance at the Redmond Rod and Gun Club, where every time I show up there, it's like a high school reunion. I see good friends like Mark and Ben and David every weekend that I never see anywhere else the rest of the year. And it's always nice to be able to carry on a conversation with them while somebody's shooting in the not too distant background and still hear every word. And that only happens because I'm wearing hearing protection from Electronic Shooters Protection. ESPAmerica.com is where you learn more about hearing protection and hearing loss. And cue the dramatic music. It is permanent and cumulative. So please take a look at ESPAmerica.com and protect yours so that the next time somebody's griping about how slow your party is moving at the sporting clays range, you'll hear about it and maybe do something. All right, Handle It is the segment from the Cabela's Podcast Studio where I share with you the things I learned the hard way so that you don't have to. And Kelly, if you're on board and not dozing off after two commercial messages, love to have you chime in as well. You know, when I was learning to be a teacher, the teacher who taught me to teach used the term that was hot and really fashionable back then, learning readiness. And what it is the pupil is sometimes prepared to take direction and sometimes not. Well, training dogs. Did I just hear a chuckle from Kelly Jobes at Bone Point Kennels?
No chuckle here.
Okay. Well, so the whole idea is when you're training a dog, I wonder how much it matters as to when you give a command, especially early on in the dog's learning of that command. I've experimented a little bit, but I haven't had near as many dogs as you have, Kelly. I've noticed that sometimes my dogs will be running past me and they'll give me a quick glance. Some of my dogs are so confused at what I do, they stop and look at me. Sometimes I have to call their name to get their attention, and then it's time to give them that command. Of course, the best time is always when they're just about ready to put their leg back down after taking a leak. You've got their undivided attention. Kelly, am I on the right track?
Yeah, for sure. You only have a split second sometimes to get that correction in when you have their attention, and you need to act quick.
Yeah.
Then they're on to something else, and it won't be as effective.
I read once that the U.S. Army tells me I have a second and a half to get in a command or a correction, or praise for that matter. Does it sound about right?
Yeah, that sounds about right. And if a Tweety Bird flies by 3/4 of a second after that, you have less than that. So
yeah, exactly.
Depends on the dog and the situation and anything else that might distract it. But that's really when it all comes down to training dogs. I mean, that's the tough part is they don't speak our language. And so trying to tell the dog what we want them to do. I mean, that's what it all comes down to. And a lot of times as we struggle to train our dogs, it's because the dogs don't know what we're asking of them. And when you break it down into simplest forms, that's really the biggest challenge. And then you have, well, they know what they're asking of them to do and they just don't want to do it. And you have to enforce it. But a lot of times when things go wrong in training and dogs are ruined or become very submissive or start to break down, it's a lot of times because they don't know what the trainer's asking them to do. And so everybody gets frustrated.
Yeah, including the dog.
And you're right. Yep. And yeah, they can shut down or act in different ways, and you're right. So knowing when to respond, when you have the dog's attention and when you can make a correction is critical.
Yeah, you know, I wrote a book a while back called What the Dogs Taught Me, and a lot of that book is built around the fundamental belief that we don't pay attention to our dogs as much as we should. We want them to give us 100% of their attention, but we don't do near as much of that, especially in the field on a hunt. And if we do, a lot of that becomes a little bit more clear to us. End of lecture, everybody. Thank you. Kelly, thanks for your chiming in on that as well. This is the Upland Nation Podcast. I'm Scott Linden. That's Kelly Jobes. He's the proprietor at bonepointkennels.com. You got any of your own puppies on the ground these days, Kelly?
Yeah, we do. We had two litters, a day apart.
Ooh.
I didn't sign up for that, but one was 11 puppies and one was 9. So I'm looking out the window at 20 puppies out in the kennel that pretty soon they'll be anxious to get out and eat their bowl full of food and run through the yard and ravage my wife's flowers and anything the kids may have left out.
Yeah, isn't that the truth? Now, just a dumb question, then we'll get to the one I left you with before the commercial break. How do you keep track? I mean, when you put them back, how do you know which ones go in that place and which ones go in that place? Or do you have any help from the mothers on that?
Well, first off, I never really had this many puppies at once. Like I said, I wasn't really set up for it or planned for it, but it just, that's how it worked out. I bred an older female, and the first time, there was a lot of expected small litters, and that's what happened. But you're right. At first, that was when they were in their whelping boxes. I was worried about a kid picking up a puppy from one and putting it back in their own one and keeping track. So we put collars on one of the litters. After they hit about 6 weeks old, they start playing pretty rough and ripping those collars off. But now I have all 20 pretty well memorized, and I know just by looking at the puppy which one goes where. But they kind of did some communal type feeding there for a while when they were 3-4 weeks old, and lay them out in the grass. All the puppies would be split between the two mothers, and the two mothers were, I mean, they were good with it. They were fine having the whelping boxes next to each other. Puppies came, puppies went, and they kind of treated them all as their own. So we really mixed them for the most part in terms of raising them.
Oh, I love it. That's so, I mean, that is actually something I bet that is a little bit funny to watch. And just for the record, everybody, Michelle or who was it? Hillary Clinton was right. It takes a village to raise a litter, if nothing else. All right. Okay.
Yeah, though I get some help from the kids for sure.
Oh, that darn right. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But I left you before the break with a trick question. When it comes to bird dogs and bird hunting, what is it that gets Kelly Jobes so excited to get up early and go a long way and climb hills? It seems like it's uphill both ways every time I go. What about you?
I think all diehard chuck runners will probably say a lot of the same thing, and it's the pursuit. And that's what it is for me. I enjoy just thrashing my legs, climbing the hill first thing in the morning, and blowing up my lungs and going out and conquering a mountain. I mean, that's a big reason why I do it, is I'm in the office most of the week, and I want to be out there climbing hills. I live in a beautiful part of the country, and I love getting out and see it. I love just watching my dogs work. I'll be on the Snake River, especially early in the season. I'm down there about when the sun's coming up because the heat, I mean, it doesn't get any prettier than that. It's just an awesome country, and being out in that, getting to enjoy it, and just being part of a day where everything went perfect with the dog work. And that doesn't happen very often, but when it does, and you're off that mountain and you have a limit of birds and you have the sweat rolling off you and the dog's satisfied, and it just all added up, and you can go home pretty satisfied. And it's not always majors about the birds. I mean, I shoot a little 20-gauge double barrel, so it's a handicap at times. But the dog work's a big part of it. I mean, I don't even think I'd hunt chuckers if it wasn't for the dogs. Just watching young dogs work, watching them figure out, a young dog that seems really clueless for a while, doesn't know its purpose, and then all of a sudden things just click. And I'd say that's probably some of the greatest satisfaction I get out of being out there bird hunting, is just watching those young dogs, watch it click for them. That never gets old.
No, it doesn't. In fact, by the way, you stole one of my lines. That's why I shoot a side-by-side, so I always have a shooting excuse. But But it's all of the above, and there is an element of, I was watching something on National Geographic about climbing Mount Everest last night, and you know, some of those hills that you and I climb feel like Mount Everest about halfway up. And there's something to be said for that, isn't there? The whole physical aspect of accomplishment.
Yeah, it is. And you climb up and then you're up at the top and you're looking down at your rig or the river. It's like, wow, that really didn't take as long as I thought it would. And it's neat. I enjoy that.
Tell me a little bit more about the hunting side of things. If you had any advice for some of our listeners who maybe want to try a chukar hunt for the first time, if you had to give them one bit of advice, what, besides getting in shape, and I mean really in shape, goblet squats are my friend. What would you tell them?
I would say a big one would be, when your dog goes on point, it's a little bit different with chuckers. And when I bring people along, often the dog goes on point and I see them go for the dog. And sometimes I forget that. They're not sure how to approach it. And it's even different than other game birds somewhat. And what I tell them is, generally there's two of us. I said, okay, here's the dog on point. Before you even go for that dog, pay attention to the wind. Pay attention to the terrain. See how is the dog's head high? Is the dog's head low? Where do we think the birds are based on that and the lay of the land and the cover? Okay? All right, so if we think the birds are here, next step, we're going to go beyond that. We're going to go cut off their escape route. So we're not even going to go for the birds, because if you go straight down them, you got this down and away shot. It's a very low percentage shot. So we're going to try to get below them, flush them over the top of us, or if the terrain's different, we're going to, somebody's going to go in for the flush, and the other person's going to cut around and cut off their alleyway. And so the first few times, I'm taking people with me, and I'm sending them to go way over here, and I'm pointing them to, because I'm trying to have them cut off the alleyway. And they thought I was, like, trying to get them out of the birds. They thought I was purposely screwing with them. And I'm like, no, watch this. I'm going to flush these birds right by you. You're going to have a passing shot. So it's a... That'd be one thing, is don't go for the dog. Identify where you think the birds are and where they're going to fly. Go cut off their alleyway.
Yeah, amen to that. Tell you, that is so true. The other thing I would add to that is, in most cases, the first hour of a chukar hunt is just really an uphill climb.
Yeah, and I'd always rather start on the bottom, because I'd rather do my climb when my legs are fresh and I'm full of enthusiasm. If I start on top, every time I drop, I'm knowing I have to climb back out of it. But yeah, and a lot of times the difference between a good day of chukar hunting and a bad day of chukar hunting for me in terms of birds at the end of the day was, how often did I put myself in a position for a high percentage shot?
Yeah.
And that's the difference. If I get below them versus shooting down on them, I mean, that's a big one. And sometimes you can't help it. Sometimes birds are wild, everything's getting into the play, but that's a big part of success, is how you set yourself up when the dog's on point. And that will make a big difference in the number of birds at the end of the day.
Yeah. Glad I got that right. I just wrote an article for Shooting Sportsman magazine on the topic, and that was in there. So I got that paragraph was correct. Good. What about your dogs? What are your expectations for a dog that's on point on a what we think is a covey of chuckers? Of course, every time that happens to me, it ends up being huns instead. But when your dog slams a point on a chucker and they start waddling away, what do you want your dog to do if you had a perfect world?
I like to give the dog the ability to use its head and its skills to handle those running birds. I don't take maybe the purest approach where a dog goes on point, it'll stay on point until I release it, because these birds run too much. And the good dogs have an knack for how close they can get. And especially when I'm allowing my dogs to get out there a long ways at times, I'd be walking up on empty points all the time if I didn't give the dog the opportunity to handle those birds. And most learn it through experience. And I also don't want to be in a position where I have to see the dog and correct the dog with the e-collar if it's taking steps and making mistakes. And when I go through the training process, I'll make the dog cautious on taking extra steps, so that's its first instinct. But in the end, the dog needs to sort out old scent, new scent, thermals coming, blowing the wind up, ground scent, and it needs to sort all that out. And because in the end, I mean, the dog has to point the birds and handle them so that you can get there and hold them. But it can't put too much pressure on them that the birds won't be there. So it's a balance. But I'd give the dog the freedom to work those birds.
Love it. Yeah, you had another thought?
No.
Oh, good. Good. We're done. No. Oh, no, we're not. We're not done, but we're getting down to the downhill side, Kelly, and you can appreciate that. You know, you did mention something that is so true, and that is why we need to be in shape. Besides climbing up hills, going down those hills at the end of the day, I mean, you could die. You can die if you make the wrong mistake on a chukar hunt. What does getting in shape have to do with that?
Yeah, you need your lungs and you need your legs.
Yeah.
And if you're gonna, there's a great benefit in my mind, not only to do the cardio, but to do some strength training in the legs. Because you're right, you're on uphill, downhill, and a lot of times you're stabilizing your legs, and you're constantly balancing, you're repositioning your legs to help balance on those hills, and that takes its toll on your legs, and that comes from a strength training, do some weights, that type of thing. I really think is a big benefit, and hitting your legs with some weights just to help that with that stability and that leg fatigue. Helps out a lot, and then it's a combination, because it's, you have to work in some cardio. I mean, if you can do some cardio like running up hills, I mean, that's really the best.
Great. Switch gears. Okay, now we're on level ground because we're at a NAVDA test, or maybe it's an AKC hunt test, or maybe it's, you know, an ASTRA for that matter. And you've been around the block a few times on all of that stuff. You would, if you were to give all of us who do that stuff regularly one bit of advice about preparing for, or actually on the day of a test, and I've had lots of great help from judges a lot of times who will tell you to do that, lay off that, whatever it is, hey, calm down, whatever. What would you tell us?
Well, I've ran in quite a few of those tests. I won't claim to be an expert, but I've made my share of mistakes out. And had some success at them. So, I mean, you learn from all of that. I don't have any just all-out tricks or silver bullets, but one thing that I have noticed is it is a big no-no is if you get really nervous or really upset at your dog, dogs know it. And I've seen several instances where a dog was unsure or a handler got very mad at the dog and it was radiating off that person. And they didn't even realize how much it was, but the dog was picking up on that. And I've seen dogs just shut down and pick up on the anger of the handler or the nerves of the handler. And I mean, how many times have you heard people say, "Joe, the dog's been perfect at that for the last 2 months and then screwed it up the test day."
Yeah.
And some of that comes down to the dog knowing it didn't have an e-collar on it and know it can get away with it. But sometimes that's the dog keying in on its handler's nerves.
Well,
or frustrations and acting on that.
I can't agree more. I was a musical performer and I understand what performance anxiety is, because I've played in front of fairly good sized crowds and I've played in front of infinitesimal crowds, you still get nervous. And then I've seen that manifest itself at hunt tests of all sort, field trials and everything else. I've marshaled and volunteered in various ways at a number of them. And it does translate. You can even see it. If a dog is on a leash, you can tell by how the handler is holding that leash, whether that dog is reading that handler or not. And I've also, out in your country once, many dogs ago, had the opposite. I got there a day early. I was running my dog around just to kind of, like everybody does, they want to do the whole test the day before. And it was going sideways. It was going sideways left, and it was going sideways right. And I finally just said, it's too late. And I used to say that with bands I was in. Hey, if we haven't got it by now, we're not going to get it overnight. So I said, I'm just going to loosen up. We're going to have a lot of fun. We're going to go through this thing and enjoy the hell out of it. And it worked. 112, prize won for a puppy that probably deserved a better trainer than he had at the time. So, you know, that psychology, it's not all psychology. There's vibrations in the air. You know that. I know that. And we've seen it happen.
Yeah, no, that's true. They pick up on that.
Yeah, they do.
They tell something's different.
Yeah, way different.
A lot of times, and just going to those tests prepared. I've made that mistake. Especially more in the last 5 years than I did 10, 15 years ago when I was running dogs, which seems backwards, but it all comes down to time. And heck, I was doing the best job training my dogs when I was in college because I just had really me to worry about. And now it's the last few dogs I ran through utility, they haven't been as polished. And that was just because I didn't take into those tests as well prepared. And if you're well prepared going to those tests, that has its way of easing your nerves. If you know the dog has done it a lot and is ready, and I ran out of time and some things fell apart for me in the field, and that's just because I was cutting corners and didn't have the time to do it the way I used to do it and the way I should have done it. So you rely on help sometimes, and if you're relying on things to go your way at a test, it rarely does.
Yeah, in fact, I've heard said that any dog can get a prize 3 in a NAVDA test. Any good dog can get a prize 2 in a NAVDA test, but it takes a good, lucky dog to get a prize 1.
Yeah, because you have to do it in so many different categories. I mean, you can get knocked down in any one of the categories to the lowest common denominator. And so it's a lot of truth to that, especially on a utility test where you can lose that in so many ways.
Oh, yeah. We don't need to dwell on that or we'll both be crying by the end of the podcast, which, by the way, is called the Upland Nation. That's Kelly Jobes with Bone Point Kennels. Learn more about them at bonepointkennels.com. I'm your host, Scott Linden. Still trying to figure things out with my fifth wire hair. And in fact, Kelly, you might remember when I was looking for another puppy, it was the wrong time of year, and I called everybody, including you. And I apologize in advance, Jeff Funky, for not calling you my main man in that world, because I didn't think you would have any either, Jeff. And then somebody said, call Jeff, probably my wife. It was the smartest move she ever made. He had yep. Two. Yep. Couldn't figure out which one to keep as his stud. I got the other one, and we ended up making the decision with a coin flip. So Flick is the B-team stud dog if Jeff ever needs him. So for what it's worth, don't tell him that. He'll get a swelled head. Not Jeff. Flick.
I remember talking to you a few times over the years.
Yeah.
Going through that next cycle, taking a look at the next round of crop to reload with. But I know you've been going back to Jeff, and that's obviously been a good source for you.
Yeah, I'm knocking wood as I say it. And you know, everybody says the same thing. This guy could be the one. But it depends on a lot of other variables. But speaking of that, variables and helping us be better hunters and dog trainers, if you had, I said, Kelly, what is figuratively within arm's reach of you right now that you don't leave home without, whether it's for training or hunting, what's that piece of gear that we probably don't have that we ought to go out and buy or make, for that matter?
No real secrets are really jumping out at me. Having a good vest and a good set of boots. Obviously the dog, that's I think we can expect that given our discussion so far, that we value good dogs, but a good quality vest that puts the weight on your waist, and good boots, a good set of mountaineering type boots, maybe not quite as stiff as the true mountaineering boots, but those mountain type hunting boots. And I think a lot of people say that, but I don't have any really secrets that I can think of, but those are the two main ones.
And both are good ones. In fact, I'm going to do a video. I did a video on what's in my vest a couple weeks ago. I'm going to do one on what is a good vest for guys like us, but you'll have to wait a little bit on that one. I got 4 more videos for somebody else to do first. How about leave us with one more bit of wisdom? If we were to stop doing one thing in particular, or start doing one thing in particular when it came to our hunting or dog training regimen, what would it be?
Well, I'll go back to kind of the checker and hunt type hunter, open Western hunter. If you're raising your puppy, and you'll hear from a lot of purists, only shoot the birds the dog points. And in some sense, that's true. But there's a few stages in the dog's learning process that first year. And I think I've heard of a lot of people that heard that and they do that. And their pup is young at 6-7 months old, and it's not covering enough ground to get on very many birds. And when they finally find something, it doesn't point it, so the bird doesn't get shot or shot at. It just didn't build excitement. And dogs need bird encounters to become bird dogs. And so what I recommend is you're out there with your puppy. When you first start, when it's pretty clueless, 4, 5, 6 months old, not so much age, but just it doesn't really know what's going on and why it's out there, and you're just taking it out. I shoot wild flushes are okay. That dog needs some birds in its mouth. It needs some shots. It needs to know while it's out there to get excited. And then once it starts to get ramped up, okay, then I go, okay, now I'm not shooting any dog or any bird the dog busts. If it doesn't handle the bird right, then I'm still going to shoot the bird. But if it's a wild flush, now we're talking a 7-8-month-old dog. There's still a lot to be learned from that dog getting a dead bird in the retrieve. So I'll shoot a wild flush when the dog's at that age. So I think that old don't shoot the bird unless the dog points it. It might be overdone for some people starting out a young dog. Birds make bird dogs, and bird encounters are a big part of that. So just kind of adjust that depending on the dog's developmental level, because that's one thing I'll throw out there.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, I like to hunt a young dog with an older dog to help them get into more bird contacts. And I think that's really good also, because it helps bring out the dog's natural backing instinct. If they're hunting with an older dog, when they're young, they learn how to back on naturally if you bring that out pretty early. And that's a critical skill if you have multiple dogs or you hunt with other people. Dogs that haven't hunted with another dog until they're 2 or older generally struggle with backing. So I like to bring that out in a really young dog. And then again, as the dogs really start stealing point and getting obnoxious, it kind of gets to that middle stage, then I might start hunting them separately if that becomes a problem. But there's some benefits in the beginning to hunting a young dog with an older dog to teach backing and to get it more bird contacts.
Words to the wise from somebody who knows. Probably the next time I see it will be up a probably halfway up a hill on the Snake River. That's one of my goals for this year. If I don't roll all the way back down again right off. That's Kelly Jobes. You can learn more about Kelly's operation, bonepointkennels.com. Bonepointkennels.com. Kelly, fun to talk with you. We got to get together sometime, maybe at Barley Brown's down there, your neck of the woods someday, real soon. Thanks so much for being a part of the Upland Nation.
Well, thanks, Scott. Thanks for having me. And absolutely, if you get over this way, give me a holler. We'll go down to Barley Brown's, have a beer, and go hit the hills together.
Good enough. Thanks a lot. The rest of you, don't go nowhere, because we're just getting warmed up on the tail end here. Got a lot more to talk about, including This Land Is Your Land. That's my public access advice for the week, and I hope it will be of value to you. I know it was to me when I learned it the first time around, believe me. And in the meanwhile, just a quick word from Gunner Kennels, man's best kennel. Learn more about them at gunner.com. The only 5-star reviewed and tested dog crate on the market. Find out why. Take a look at their website. Take the Fit Finder quiz and check out the augmented reality app. Put your dog next to the kennel. Put your kennel in your truck. You can even crowdsource your fit. Talk to everybody else who's got dogs like you. It's all at gunner.com. Dogtra makes the TNB Dual. Took me a while to figure that out. Tone and Beep TNB Dual. You got the choice there. The other nice thing about it is you can control 2 collars with one hand. No toggling, no trying to find something on the touch screen. 2 sets of buttons. Works perfectly even if you can't see the dang screen. Dogtra.com is where you learn more about them. Use the what do we call them? Coupon codes, checkout codes. Use SLUN10 at dogtra.com for 10% off anything over $200 and free shipping for anything over $200 as well. Thank you to our sponsors. They do give us the time and resources to bring you this podcast. This Land Is Your Land, and today we're going to talk a little bit about travel plans and preparation. You got the Upland checklist yet? Go to findbirdhuntingspots.com and download your copy of the ultimate Upland checklist. The only thing not on there is the semi-truck you need to haul everything. At least you won't forget something. Devil is in the details when it comes to that sort of thing, and particularly if you're far from home and your dog goes missing. So far, knocking wood, it's only been a temporary situation with us, and that's one reason I always put a GPS collar on my dog. But one of the things I also have underneath the back seat in my pickup truck is an envelope with these things in it. A number of copies of a lost dog poster with my dog's picture on it and all the usual information, plus my cell phone number and my landline number, just in case one works and one doesn't. Bring your dog's license number and a stack of those printed flyers, plus some duct tape to mount those flyers everywhere in the vicinity of where you lost that dog. I hope it never happens to you, but if it does, you will be prepared. That is my travel tip for this week, brought to you by findbirdhuntingspots.com. Lots of information on travel right there, and also traveling to Huron, South Dakota. One of my favorite places. I'll be back there yet again this fall. It's where the pheasants outnumber the people. 124,000 acres of public access within 60 miles of downtown Huron. Learn more at hunthuronsd.com. And thank you again for their support. ESPAmerica.com is where you learn all about electronic shooters protection for your ears. A number of choices there. It's all at ESPAmerica.com. Well, thank you, Kelly Jobes. I think that might be the longest conversation I've ever had with you, and boy, did I learn a lot. I hope everybody else out there learned something as well. If you like the podcast, I sure would appreciate a rating or review at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or iHeartRadio. That kind of stuff really helps a lot. The conversation is constant at the Wing Shooting USA Facebook page and at the Upland Nation Facebook page. So join me there anytime. Suggestions, advice, criticism, yeah, go ahead. I'm used to it. We are in a weird state. I don't mean Oregon, which is weird anyway, but I mean state of mind, state of everything with this wacky pandemic. But some things are always true. Hug your dog, keep your family close, stay in touch with your friends, and know that we will be hunting this fall, come hell or high water. I'll see you in the field. Thanks for listening. I'm Scott Linden. Talk to you soon.